Sigma Alpha Epsilon. It's one of the oldest fraternities in the country and one of the largest. Its peak membership a couple years ago was 15,000 undergraduates. This hour, we look at the complicated existence of campus fraternities. On one hand, their members learn leadership skills and make lifelong friendships. There's a pathway into valuable career networks that can pay dividends later on. And then there's that other side, more often in the news headlines, the hazing, the binge drinking, the sexual assaults. John Heckinger is a senior editor at Bloomberg News and is the author of the new book, True Gentlemen, The Broken Pledge of America's Fraternities. John, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Well, we just saw in those latest headlines, Florida State University announcing Monday it's suspending all fraternities and sororities for an unspecified period of time after a 20-year-old who was pledging a fraternity was found unresponsive the morning after attending a party. Let's listen to FSU's president, John Thrasher.
My belief is the fraternities and sororities are going to come to us and say, let's fix this. I think they're the quality of students. By and large at FSU or that kind of student. And I think they exist in the fraternities and sororities. We just need a pause though to kind of make sure that we're after those solutions and doing the right thing to correct these issues.
Talking a lot in generalizations there, John, what's your assessment of this reaction to this death?
Well, we've seen this reaction on a number of campuses across the country. You have a horrific episode and the president will suspend activity and be shocked at what he's hearing about, and then after several months, it's often back to business as usual. Now, I think that we've had enough this year that we may be reaching kind of a tipping point, and President Thrasher is talking about trying to kind of come up with a new kind of culture at Greek houses, a new normal, he talks about, and I think that there is an opportunity here, and I've talked to a lot of national leaders at fraternities who are open to working with colleges to try to make changes, such as banning alcohol at parties. So there's an opportunity for change.
Banning alcohol at parties, binge drinking is a huge issue here. Is that even feasible to ban alcohol? Is that pie in the sky?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, you're not going to be able to ban all drinking, but you have a situation in colleges that have a large fraternity culture where the fraternity houses are essentially underage bars. You have underage men serving underage men and women, and it's an open secret, basically. Often the campus police look the other way until there's a sexual assault or a death. And enforcement is certainly an option. And what I found in my research is that when schools improve enforcement and when fraternities start enforcing their rules and they basically get the liquor out of the frat house, not all the time, but they certainly reduce it. You can't have perfect compliance. Drinking levels go down, accidents go down, fraternities are businesses, their insurance rates go down. So I don't think it's pie in the sky at all.
Early on in your book, you write that few American institutions face as wide a chasm between high-minded ideals that we see in fraternities, the code of ethics and so forth, and the real reality that's in that we're seeing in these frat houses. Explain the divergence here.
Well, if you look back at the history of fraternities, they've had kind of a split personality. So there's a strain of a belief in scholarship and improving campus life. I mean, the first fraternities, it was Phi Beta Kappa, founded in 1776, which is now the foremost scholarship organization in America. Mm. And these early fraternities, the ones that we have today that really started in the 19th century, they started out partly as literary societies, as places where people would argue about American literature, which is actually kind of almost a forbidden subject on campuses, which were focused on Latin and Greek. So they breathed new life into colleges. The kind of activities we see today in terms of philanthropy and leadership are certainly part of the fraternity culture, but also from the beginning, college presidents were condemning them because there was just terrible drinking, what they often called spreeing. There were riots. There was misogynistic behavior against the women who were joining the campus, exclusion of newcomers. So there, it's like a kind of a Jekyll and Hyde situation.
Why has that tradition continued of a Jekyll and Hyde situation? Why can't there be more, you know, why do we see hazing out of control? Why does this continue to happen with the deaths of fraternity pledges? Why can't it stop?
That is such a good question. And again, the hazing in particular, you can trace that back at fraternities to the 19th century. It grew much worse after the Civil War when hazing in the military started coming on to returning men started doing much more brutal hazing at fraternities. And really, it dates back to, you know, British boarding schools with upperclassmen, you know, abusing freshmen. So fraternities have tried to take this on for years. I saw it in meetings where in the 30s and 40s there was this effort to eliminate what they call Hell Week, which still exists, where the hazing reaches a crescendo and often where the deaths occur. So what I saw is that over the years there was an idea that we'd kind of restrict the kind of hazing we do. We won't do the terrible kind of hazing. We understand it's going to be unpleasant. And then more recently there's been an effort to say no hazing at all. But one thing has kept constant. They still have pledging, which is kind of the fraternity's education period, the months-long initiation period.
This rite of passage into Greek life. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a cherished tradition. But it's also a time where freshmen in particular, they're second-class citizens, they're literally dying to belong. And, you know, it's inevitable that we have these deaths, particularly because the kind of hazing that the fraternities often do involves alcohol. So alcohol is a poison in large levels, and young men often don't know their tolerance. So I think it continues to happen because there continues to be pledging. And in the book, when focusing on SAE, that was one of the stories I wanted to tell. SAE had a brutal history of hazing. They had more deaths than any other fraternity in America, 10 over the almost decade-long period that I studied. And they were in danger of losing their insurance coverage, and basically going out of business. So they, 3.5 years ago, they eliminated pledging. Young men would become members instantly. And since then, they haven't had another death. So that's another reform that FSU might want to consider.
Talking right now with John Hechinger. He is a senior editor at Bloomberg News, the author of the new book, True Gentlemen, The Broken Pledge of America's Fraternities. You can join in this conversation, 800-642-1234. Do you see a disconnect between the lofty goals of fraternities, the fundraising, and what actually happens there? Whose responsibility is it to clean up bad behavior and to deal with the toxic culture that can be found in some fraternities? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. John, to understand this divide, you spent some years traveling the country, embedding yourself in SAE, Sigma Alpha Epsilon. Curious, how did you get on the inside of fraternities? Because there is also this very much a firewall, if you will, for outsiders to be able to get access to what goes on inside fraternities.
Well, they've been very secretive organizations for centuries. That's definitely true. What was so interesting about SAE and why I found the fraternity such a kind of the best sort of main character for the story that I wanted to tell is that after a colleague and I did a series of investigative stories that largely focused on SAE, the leadership, particularly the president at the time, Brad Cohn, really took action, as I said before, eliminated pledging, and then was quite open about inviting me to events. And I did a story for Bloomberg about that, and in terms of doing the story, he and other leaders were very open to my looking at their archives, to visiting meetings. And what they told me, and they've told me since the book has come out, that they want to change, and that it's important for the truth to come out. It's important for the young men who are joining SAE to understand that these traditions can be very, 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 very deadly. And so it was really, you know, to some degree, a testament to their desire for reform.
These traditions happening across Ivy League, happening across all sectors and classes, if you will, of universities that you documented in your book. What is this relationship like between campuses, colleges, and their fraternities? Are they codependent on each other?
That's a good way to put it. In the book, I think of it as kind of a troubled marriage. You know, these are organizations that both need each other, but are very sort of wary of each other. So on the university side, fraternities, including FSU, endorse fraternity life wholeheartedly on their websites. And they do this because Greek life is a powerful draw for recruiting students. You know, a good social scene is something that particularly out-of-state students that pay full freight are interested in. And also the fraternities, members of fraternities tend to be the most loyal donors. And they're the biggest donors, the most frequent donors. When I looked at Indiana University, which has a very vibrant scene, I found a document that showed that they represented 19% of alumni, but 60% of donations.
Mm.
So, you know, and then there's also the research that shows that that students have a better sense of well-being when they belong and feel better prepared. So there are these very laudable aspects. So, you know, typically what happens then is they look the other way about some of the behavior that's happening at these basement parties where, you know, women are assaulted or where, you know, there's hazing at initiation rituals.
And we're going to get to the sexual assault in a moment here, but I want to go back to the notion also that I was just taken aback about the real estate itself on college campuses and the vast amount of holdings of real estate these fraternities have on college campuses across America.
It is really, it's astonishing. $3 billion in real estate. They have a quarter of a million students. Fraternities are the largest landlord outside of the colleges themselves. So that's another reason. I mean, they serve they're deeply ingrained in both the social life, in the housing, in the power structures, in the alumni donations. So I didn't belong to a fraternity, so I didn't really realize how central they were to higher education.
And in terms of when housing is at a crunch for some universities who are trying to deal with upgrading dorms, taking dorms offline, it can seem that fraternities and sororities can fill a niche there in housing.
Right. What fraternities will say is that, you know, if colleges were to ban fraternities, and I should say that I don't see that happening despite many calls for it, you know, colleges would have to spend billions of dollars to build dorms to house people. And fraternities are particularly strong in the big public universities that educate something like three-quarters of college students. So, you know, they're something that have to, you know, their culture has to be confronted if you want to do something about, you know, all the problems of student life.
There are accounts of criminal behavior inside fraternities and the clear evidence of class privilege. The Greek system skews toward white, upper-class people, upper-class families, but these fraternities, they're not going out of existence. We're looking at the fraternities through the stories and history of Sigma Alpha Epsilon. Author John Hechinger stays with us. His new book is True Gentlemen. He explores the troubling aspects of fraternal organizations and how colleges have come to depend on their existence. Your questions, 800-642-1234. Do you see a disconnect between the goals of what fraternities want to do and what actually happens there? Whose responsibility is it to maintain the culture of fraternities? Can you relate to this conversation? Did you go through hazing? What is your relationship like to your fraternity? 800-642-1234. or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll return in a moment. When did hazing get so out of control? That's a lingering question, a takeaway from the new book, True Gentlemen, The Broken Pledge of America's Fraternities. We're exploring the complicated nature of fraternities in America with author John Hechinger. He's a senior editor at Bloomberg News. The period of pledging is supposed to be a time for new members to learn the history, to learn the rituals of the fraternity, but this time can have a very harmful underside. We're talking about the Greek system on campuses this hour. Your thoughts, welcome. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. Do you think we need these organizations? Would campuses be better off without them? And what questions do you have about fraternities in America today? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Nick called in from La Crosse, and he says, individuals are responsible for their own actions, and it's a person's choice to participate in hazing rituals. He says each individual must draw his or her own line. John, how would you respond to Nick there?
We know there are a lot of people who have that feeling, but I should point out that there are hazing laws in most states, and the consent of the victim is not a defense, because by definition, if you are hazed, you agreed to participate at least initially. And often these problems escalate. I spoke to one of the chapters. I spoke to a young man in Maryland who desperately wanted to join SAE and saw some of the benefits to his life. He wanted to work on Wall Street. SAE is very powerful in finance. And he signed a statement with the college that that no hazing is allowed. So he thought this was going to be, you know, he wasn't naive. He realized maybe he'd have to fetch some coffee for people or maybe clean the frat house. But then what he experienced was just an escalation of, you know, being locked in a dark basement for 9 hours while this loud metal music played and being asked to drink until he nearly passed out. And once you get into that cycle, it's hard to get out. He did actually finally quit, so he did make that decision. And he took the brave step of actually of calling the police because he thought people could have died. So, I mean, is it really? First of all, there's a law against it, so that's the other thing. And also there's, you know, a lot of psychological research in terms of peer pressure. And when you have an 18-year-old away from home for the first time and you have a senior who's maybe a bit of a sadist who's asking you to do something and saying, well, the worst will be over, everyone else did it, aren't, you know, often there's kind of preying on a young man's sense of manhood. You know, it's not something that's that I guess most of society would want to tolerate.
So if the student, the applicant, the pledge, does not go through with this peer pressure, with this hazing, will they be able to become part of the fraternity?
No, I mean, that's the sort of definition of hazing is that you have to do this to be part of the group. And, you know, the military, you know, still has a problem with hazing, but it used to be institutionalized. And the military, which is kind of often the model for this kind of behavior, has tried to stamp it out because they don't believe it really helps with cohesion at all. It doesn't really. And certainly if what you want is to have these people be your brothers, I mean, in what family do you want to have a parents or brothers beat, you know, beat, deprive you of sleep? There's a case in just recently at in New York State of, you know, pledges being asked to eat vile substances and then, you know, being literally vomited and urinated on. This is not behavior that most of society would feel is should be legal.
Let's explore also this class structure system, if you will, that has been the historical tradition of fraternities, that they skew upper class middle white families, upper class families, white families that, and there are pretty high fees to be in these organizations. I think you cited something like $7,000 to be in a fraternity. These are not diverse places of people of all backgrounds.
I mean, if you look at any kind of study, you'll see that fraternity members tend to be wealthier than non-fraternity members. They tend to be whiter. I think it's something like the best research I saw said 3 to 4% perhaps are African American, and it, in fact, it's often skewed because there are certain parts of the country which are much more open to minorities, and certain parts that aren't, and certain chapters. So you'll find chapters that don't have any black members, and even some that, as I found in Alabama, have never had a black member. You're right. It's extremely stratified. I should point out one of the examples in the book was from the University of Wisconsin at Madison, where SAE was suspended after a black student said he experienced 18 months of racial epithets and homophobic and anti-Semitic behavior, he also reported. And it was kind of, the way he presented it was kind of like people treated it as a joke. They would say these things and say, no offense, as if to sort of absolve themselves, kind of idea that there's something fun about, engaging in this kind of, politically incorrect behavior. This is something that, again, is not unique to SAE. A lot of the social science research that I looked at showed that when black members join white fraternities, they often find themselves in kind of a uncomfortable situation, treated as tokens and I should also say, though, I spoke to black members who really treasured their experience, too. So there's an opportunity there to kind of integrate an experience in campus. I mean, campuses are generally very segregated in many ways. So I saw this as both, these are horrifying examples, but I also think that there's an opportunity for fraternities to change their culture, to welcome people of diverse backgrounds, and perhaps, create essentially a diverse group of brothers, and chapters have done that. It's possible.
Let's move to the discussion of sexual assault and how that has been handled, allegations and court cases, sexual assault in fraternities. When women enter these parties, what did you find happening in your reporting?
Well, typical fraternity party is controlled by young men, and it is if you're a male student, it's often hard to get into these parties. So the men that are there tend to be fraternity members and friends of fraternity members and potential recruits. Often, though, all women are welcome, and so you have this what's called the ratio, 2 or 3 times the number of women to men, and often fraternity members will sort of set the conditions. They'll require costumes that are, basically women are scantily clad when they come in. And then there's this, huge amount of alcohol, often hard liquor. And you put all that together and you have what an environment that one sociologist told me makes sexual assault a predictable outcome. And the research is pretty clear that women who frequent fraternity parties run 1.5 times the risk of sexual assault.
So if this happens, why is not police stepping in? Are universities just looking the other way at when these parties happen? Where is the criminal crackdown here?
Yes, I'd say they are looking the other way. You see these fraternity rows, and often the campus police are right nearby, and the campus police, in a way, kind of serve to protect the fraternities from the local police, because they're not going to enforce the drinking laws unless something terrible happens. And you do see again and again this shock that there was a sexual assault. Part of the reason there isn't a crackdown is as it's very difficult to prove the sexual assaults. I looked at 5 years, and I found 15 reports at SAE. But in most cases, you can't figure out what happens. You know, women often, first of all, women generally don't report sexual assault. And when they do, and if there's alcohol involved, the police have a very difficult time bringing conviction. Colleges have been stepping up their disciplinary actions against men accused of sexual assault. But now the Trump administration is actually backing off that. It's basically saying that these that there have been too many cases where men have been expelled or disciplined on flimsy evidence, which, in fact, there have been. It's very, very difficult to police sexual assaults. And, you know, what I recommend in the book is to think about this as a public health issue, to try to change the environment. If more assaults are being reported in certain spaces, such as fraternity parties, take alcohol out and enforce those rules, and, you know, I suspect that you'd have fewer sexual assaults. And there's some evidence of that.
You trace the story of Gabriella and her sexual assault, multiple sexual assaults, and what happened to her in the criminal justice system, in court. Take us through her story. And what's really fascinating to me is the questioning of detectives of the people who were allegedly involved in her assault and how they were covering for their fraternity brothers.
Well, you see this again and again, and often you can't find out what happened, but you do see cases where fraternity men will cover up evidence, will decline to talk to the police. And, you know, again, that does not, in terms of the values of the true gentleman that we're looking at, this is certainly a violation of the values that they're trying to espouse. In the case that I looked at Johns Hopkins, you know, this was a case where a 16-year-old girl goes with her older sister to a fraternity party, and as I said, women are basically, and girls, it turns out, are pretty much welcome to this what's called an invite-only party, and she's barely drunk before, and she gets all these fireball whiskey shots and is basically incapacitated. And two other men who aren't members of the fraternity, but who were, at least one was an invited guest and a friend of the social chairman, attacked her in a basement. It was a terrible, terrible situation. And what was interesting to me is that on the campus, it has until now been betrayed as really not the fraternity's fault, that people from outside the fraternity came in, we can't police everybody, and, you know, these were strangers who came in and did this. But that's not what I found at all, that at least one of them was definitely not a stranger. He had been to other parties. And what's actually unique about this case is the fact that Gabriella was brave enough to come forward. She did everything that law enforcement tells people to do. She immediately reported it. She went for an exam, and she testified. I watched her testify. Quite brave, and so the two men were convicted. But that's really the anomaly. It's the only case I could find in the 15 where that happened. So in a way, it's unusual that we found out what happened, and that anyone was brought to justice. But the circumstances, the environment that the fraternity created that made sexual assault likely, and then the denials and the circling of the wagons are typical.
What was the outcome in the case? They were convicted. Did they serve time?
Yes, five year sentences. So they were convicted. And again, that is the exception that proves the rule.
Beyond DNA evidence, though, these cases, like you say, are few and far between, and you have to bring a lot of proof. You also mentioned that in the questioning period of the accused, that they were speaking like the legalese they would be representing a corporation and not just speaking on their own, that they considered the fraternity almost this perhaps a business entity.
I think not the accused, but the this was the social chairman.
Right, social chairman.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, I mean, you know, you had a situation where he set up the party and was interviewed by detectives. And in the book, I go over kind of a transcript of the discussion where he's clearly not volunteering any evidence. He's, you know, they really have to press him before he gives any information, and does seem to be most concerned with protecting the fraternity. And that, I think, is something that the campus was not aware of. If you look at the Johns Hopkins paper, they basically portrayed the chapter as being unfairly disciplined for something that wasn't their fault, that they cooperated with the police. And at least, you know, not everyone seemed to be, you know, fully cooperative.
Is there a sense, John, that Sigma leadership, whom you talked to, realized a turning point, that something had to change? You mentioned that they were on the brink of losing insurance. Very practical, didn't think of that, but was that a turning point? What was the turning point?
I think that was the turning point. You know, I'm a business journalist as well as an education writer, and I always look at the finances. And, you know, these are businesses as well as social organizations. And they were facing extinction. I mean, SAE, like other fraternities, had been facing multi-million dollar lawsuits. And, you know, they were, as one leader put it to me, a judgment away from extinction. And I think when they heard that they might lose their insurance, they realize they basically have to shut down. And, you know, these members, the leadership, these are people who have devoted their lives to the fraternities. They often, you know, they're the groomsmen at their weddings, the pallbearers at their funerals will be members of SAE, and they want their children to belong. And they felt that for the organization to exist, they had to do something dramatic. And so that's why there was a turning point. And so that's why when you see what's happening at FSU, the important thing is for this to actually yield some real structural changes, like not having alcohol at fraternity parties or banning pledging, rather than just saying, you know, it's a few bad apples.
But can campus compacts, signing your name on the dotted line, can that really hold up when it comes to peer pressure and hazing and what is going on behind the walls of these large, large houses on campus?
It's a challenge, no doubt. But enforcement is extremely important. The issue about pledging, which is interesting, is that it's actually hard to have an organized pledge program and no one know about it. That's why it's so hard to get rid of hazing, because you can say, oh, we were just pledging. We didn't know what was happening down there. But if you have an organized pledge program, pledge educators, and you see these guys like walking around campus dressed in outrageous clothes, you know that they're doing some form of pledging, and you can shut them down for that. And one of the things that SAE did, they shut down something like 30 chapters, probably more than 30 chapters. So the fraternity took action. The colleges obviously have to do some kind of enforcement. The other public pressure, you know, the plaintiff's lawyers have been a very powerful force here. You know, they're going to be lawsuits, I'm sure, in these latest cases. All of this kind of public pressure can make an enormous difference. And look, you know, SAE is going to be the first to admit there's probably people who aren't following its rules. But if you think about it in terms of public health, if you make the behavior more expensive and you enforce the rules, think about cigarette smoking. We still have smoking. We have a lot less of it. That's really the goal.
The title of the book is True Gentlemen. It's the phrase from the creed of the Sigma Alpha Epsilon fraternity, arguably the most powerful fraternity in the country with more than 230 chapters nationwide. Universities have disciplined more than 130 chapters over the past 5 years. We're discussing the place of fraternities in society with the author, John Hechinger. He's a senior editor at Bloomberg News. Gathering your thoughts on fraternities as well, there's a line for you at 800-642-1234. Do you see a disconnect between the goals of fraternities, the future rewards of fraternities in careers, and what actually happens during Pledge Week? Whose responsibility is it to enforce and figure out how to clean up bad behavior and toxic culture at fraternities? We'll return in a moment. Fraternities are big business. They control $3 billion in real estate assets on about 800 campuses nationwide. Pretty staggering statistic. We're looking at their codependence with universities, their history, and the troubles they face today with complaints and allegations of racism, misogyny, sexual assault making headlines around the country from big-name universities to lesser prestigious ones. The new book is True Gentlemen, The Broken Pledge of America's Fraternities. John Hechinger stays with us. Your thoughts as well, 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about fraternities? Are you worried about your own son or daughter navigating Greek life on campus? 800-642-1234. Let's go to Tom now in Plover. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Good morning. I just thought it was timely. You're on the newscast. They're talking about a push from the Wisconsin Tavern League with trying to reduce the age of purchase of alcohol. And since a quality of the fraternity system is to have that ability of the underage tavern. what about public policy beyond? What should states be doing beyond the campus? This seems like it wouldn't be a very helpful. This seems like the Tavern League would like to sell more and
more
card
alcohol.
Less and lose less liquor licenses.
Tom, thanks for the call. Let's get John in here to respond. John, go ahead.
Well, that is often raised as a solution. In 2008, there were a number of college presidents who wanted to lower the drinking age. Public health authorities overwhelmingly support the 21-year-old drinking age, and the research is pretty clear that it saved tens of thousands of lives. Actually, the rate of drinking for people of college and high school age has actually been going down, believe it or not. And one really interesting point that the data show is that the drinking levels are higher for college students than non-college students. And what's probably the difference? Enforcement. So, yes, if you made it more available, you wouldn't have to enforce the rules. It'd be easier for colleges, but you'd probably have even more drinking. That's certainly what the research shows, and you have more deaths, not fewer.
Tom, thanks for the call. Let's go to Doug now in Lancaster. Hi, Doug. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. About 20 years ago, I was a member of Pi Sigma Epsilon at UW-Whitewater, a non-traditional fraternity with traditional roots. So non-traditional, as a matter of fact, we were co-ed. Basically, unfortunately, what I've seen happening is because of the behavior of some of these traditional fraternities, there's a natural reaction from universities to clamp down on that behavior. And unfortunately, that does transition over to non-traditional and even student organizations that don't have traditional Greek roots. So much so that I will say this, if it weren't for Pi Sigma Epsilon, I wouldn't have chosen a career path in sales and marketing. We ran a sales project, which gave me the foundational skills that I needed for a career in sales. they can't even do that project anymore because of the rules the university has clamped down on. So I see an unfortunate backlash towards student organizations that are actually trying to provide a service and build skills needed for the real world.
John, go ahead.
I mean, that's an excellent point. And that's why in the book, I'm unlike many, I'm not calling for a ban on fraternities. I'm calling for, a change in behavior. It's not clear to me that fraternities like Doug's couldn't survive, without having alcohol at the center of their culture. The kind of philanthropy and the service and the brotherhood, these are real. And, I've talked to many members of SAE who said literally that this organization changed their lives and may have actually saved their lives in terms of, feelings of loneliness and despair. And the brothers really helped them. So, I think it's true that a lot could be lost if those kinds of bonds are left. And Doug also makes a good point that, so this chapter sounds like it voluntarily went co-ed, and that's something that, chapters could definitely consider. Fraternities nationally will fight in court to keep the right to be single sex, and it's actually enshrined in sort of higher education law that they can be. So it's tough, but there's nothing stopping a chapter from accepting women and seeing if that makes a difference, and it certainly seems like it can.
Doug, thanks for the call there. Let's go to Linda now in Ashland. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I just wanted to make the comment that when our son was visiting campuses and looking for a college, one of his criteria or priorities was that he wanted to go to a university that did not have fraternities or sorority culture. I think it was from a social justice or aspect, but it wasn't that it wasn't important. It was important that there not be a fraternity culture. I'll listen off the air.
And are there colleges around the country that do not allow fraternities and sororities?
Yes, there are. The most famous example is Williams College, which in the 60s decided to gradually phase out fraternities and then ban them. If you go to Williams and you're found to belong to join a fraternity, you'll be expelled. And what Williams found, it was very controversial, but in the 60s, fraternities were at their weakest, kind of during the counterculture. They were able to do it. The Williams example is, it transformed itself from what would now be called a party school to one of the top-ranked colleges in the country. People thought they would lose money from alumni. In fact, they're the wealthiest liberal arts college in America. So Williams and Middlebury and Bowdoin, Colby, these are some sort of small peer New England colleges. They've decided not to have fraternities. But I should say that that's really not typical. First of all, they can do it because they're private organizations. Government organizations will find it hard because of the First Amendment to forbid someone from joining an organization. So that's not really an option at the University of Wisconsin, for example.
Let's take another call now. Arnold in Madison. Arnold, hi.
Good morning. This is a gentleman who happened to be working for one of the security agencies that did everything from football games in Madison to whatever. I was sent one night to one of the Greek organizations, and I don't remember what it was because it's many, many years ago, and to, quote, police the party. The next morning I called my supervisor and said I would not work that place unless there were at least four of us, because I was just totally bowled over. And I said, there's going to be problems, there's going to be violations of law, and you folks as the security are going to have problems and probably be sued. And as far as I know, the security company said that they would no longer police some of these Greek organizations.
Arnold, thank you for that story. John, is this still the case today that fraternity parties have policing inside the party?
I think if they had, by definition, they can't really have policing if they're serving minors.
Minors, uh-huh.
So, this is, I think, one of the the fundamental issues of fraternities that I struggled with. There's a lot of lying going on because of at the center is serving alcohol to minors, and they can't really admit doing it because it's a crime. So, I understand that it's not only at fraternities, but fraternities, the research shows that fraternity men drink at something at least double the level of everyone else on campus, so they're kind of the center of it. I don't see why the campus police, I walked around to many campuses, I could see the parties going on. They could stop them if they wanted to.
Arnold, thank you for the call. John, what do you see as the future here for fraternities on college campuses?
Well, I think that they kind of have a choice here. They can kind of double down on their kind of sense of grievance. They often view themselves as some kind of sort of persecuted group by the kind of, liberal campuses that want to regulate behavior. And that perhaps could be effective for a while. But we see, campuses are now much more diverse than they've ever been, and they're going to continue to become more diverse. Women are increasingly the majority on campus, and I think that if they want to continue to have the role, at least a respectable role, and to kind of build on this sort of legacy of philanthropy and service and leadership, they themselves are going to have to figure out a way to change. They're going to have to enforce these rules, and if not, I think what you'll see is that they will eventually. Right now, they're more popular than ever, I just don't see that happening in 20 years if they don't change their ways.
And where is Sigma Alpha Epsilon in its story of evolution?
Well, they've had, the last 3.5 years since this pledge ban, there's been a remarkable turnaround. As I mentioned before, they haven't had any deaths. They're smaller. I think they're now 12,000 members because they've shut down so many fraternities. And there's so many chapters. And, I look a lot at insurance because that's really where some of the best data comes in. And their insurance claims have dropped something like 90%. So it's not perfect, as the leadership will say, but it certainly seems like, as their general counsel told me, there's been some kind of cultural shift that, people who want to haze seem to basically not be going to SAE. And you have to think that there's been a reduction in drinking as well, because drinking is sort of the foundation of all these other problems. So,
But will the legacy and tradition continue? Will the alums of Sigma say, "I want my son to follow in my footsteps"?
Well, it's such an interesting question. I went to the 2017 biennial convention, and actually there was a proposal to bring back pledging. And, the current leadership brought out the data and about the success, and it was eliminated. But it kind of showed that they need to constantly be vigilant. I mean, people will be bringing back. If others don't eliminate pledging, there's going to be pressure. And I spoke a lot to Judd Horace, who's the new head of the national organization that represents all the major fraternities. And he's suggesting that there be campus-wide efforts, that you get the entire interfraternity council to agree to something. And in fact, Ball State University recently, their interfraternity council signed on to an effort to eliminate alcohol at their chapter houses.
John, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Kate.
John Hechinger is a senior editor at Bloomberg News, the author of True Gentlemen, The Broken Pledge of America's Fraternities. This hour of the morning show was produced by Chris Molina and Keely Baltina. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're with us on the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for listening.